A few months ago, when Ted Kyle approached me about speaking to you folks, originally it was going to be one morning, and I thought, "Oh, one off. That's fine." And then it became clear as we talked, it was actually there was an option of doing the whole a whole month. I said, "Sure, why not? That would be a challenge. I've never done anything like that before." And so as I was sketching out what the topic would be, Ted was particularly interested in social justice. I said, "Oh, this is what I'll do, blah blah blah, and I'll break it down like this and that and so forth." And I did not look at the calendar because I did not realize that it would be in February, which is Black History Month. And since I am the official columnist of Black History Month, I thought it would be kind of ridiculous not to have some element that referred to that month, especially when it comes to prophets. And I thought, Martin Luther King, in fact, embodies a lot of the elements that I want to get at. And I thought, yeah, so I'm just going to slide a little bit of my MLK thing into this larger enterprise and use some of the elements that I was going to use for this week, next week. So, it's still about prophets, but we're going to look at one particular personage that we're familiar with in our culture. Now, it goes without saying that being a prophet is a drag. Just ask any prophet if you can find one alive and kicking. The last days of Martin Luther King Jr., arguably America's last undisputed heavyweight prophet, is very instructive on this point. Martin Luther King spent the last year of his life as a social and political pariah. His marriage was on the rocks, a casualty of his accumulated infidelities, and time away from home being the conscience of the civil rights movement. Thanks to his full-throated denunciation of the Vietnam War and American militarism, he was persona non grata at the Johnson White House. Many of his colleagues in the civil rights movement had lost faith in his leadership. This is 1967, 1968. They felt he had taken his eye off the ball of racial justice by spending too much time criticizing the war. It also hadn't been lost on many of the black preachers who were among his harshest critics that the military was the only institution in American life where blacks could move up the ranks and have whites under their command. To retreat from military service just because Vietnam fit Dr. King's definition of an unjust war would represent a significant step back from the opportunities afforded by a recently desegregated military machine. Besides older allies, a significant segment of young people in the movement had grown increasingly impatient with MLK's rhetoric and nonviolent tactics. They were attracted to the militancy of the Black Power movement and its fiery, charismatic young leaders who consider MLK an Uncle Tom for his insistence on a Christocentric pacifism. It didn't help that MLK's one-time rival, former Nation of Islam spokesman Malcolm X, had a posthumous bestseller that provided a dramatic contrast to MLK in style and substance. Malcolm X had been assassinated in 1965, but the autobiography of Malcolm X had become required reading by youth of all races and backgrounds, attracted by the author's uncompromising critique of America's racial hypocrisy. The 1963 March on Washington, where Dr. King had waxed eloquently on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial about his dream for the kind of racial justice that would transform America had begun to feel like a distant, foolish dream itself. Even the media fell out of love with the man who had once galvanized the nation with his stirring oratory. He was mocked relentlessly for his utopianism by the left and regarded as a communist dupe by conservatives who were convinced he got his marching orders from Moscow. After all, hadn't all racism in America ended with the signing of the Voting Rights and Civil Rights Acts of 1964 and 1965? What else could Negroes possibly want after gaining the right to sit at lunch counters all over the South and take whatever seat they wanted on public buses? This should have been the culmination of Dr. King's dream as far as his right-wing critics were concerned. And there were places where MLK continued to be honored, but for the most part, he was considered a moral scold who had lost his touch when it came to organizing successful protests. He wanted desperately to turn attention to the economic injustices that had created the ghettos of the northern cities. He wanted to turn the national spotlight on cities like Chicago and Cleveland and Boston and Philadelphia, because they were places that lacked the outward manifestations of Jim Crow while retaining its institutional inertia. At the same time, Dr. King's prophetic dream had evolved to the point where economic justice had become a necessary corollary for racial justice. Instead of sticking to the old script that concentrated on righting racial indignities, he critiqued the very structures of American life. He linked militarism and rapacious capitalism to the prison industrial complex and structural racism. Though he wasn't a feminist yet, he slowly began to wake up to the injustices that women of all races had to bear in a culture that devalued and relegated their contributions to the sidelines. MLK was self-aware enough to know that women were treated as second-class citizens even in the civil rights movement. So he couldn't escape blame as an oppressor himself. He struggled mightily with the log in his own eye, even as he called the nation to repent of its hypocrisies. He was not reluctant about criticizing the church, especially those who preferred spiritual complacency to action. Dr. King was scandalized by the fact that two separate but unequal churches, one black, one white, existed in America at 11 a.m. every Sunday morning. He never tired of pointing this out, especially when he was preaching to overwhelmingly white congregations, deep in denial about their unwillingness to break with the majority culture's racial assumptions. In this country, Christians had allowed Christ to be divided by the heresy of white supremacy and functional apartheid. The double-mindedness of worshiping Jesus, a swarthy, diminutive Jew who looked nothing like the blue-eyed Norwegian in most stained glass windows, went right over people's heads. Sure, Jesus was originally a Jew, but by the power of American magical thinking, he had been transformed into an honorary white man who had the same values and prejudices of people determined to ignore everything he stood for. The tiny pieces of Wonder Bread and grape juice served once a month for communion at most American churches had been stripped of transformative power. Instead of conforming the American church into the image of Jesus, a reverse transformation took place. What should have been the disruptive presence of the Holy Spirit became a docile protector of the status quo, and in black and white churches. Whites weren't ready to challenge the housing policies and white flight that created exclusively white neighborhoods and churches, and blacks weren't interested in worshiping where they weren't welcome. This dynamic continues to this day. On top of everything, the FBI was spying on Dr. King while ignoring the growing chorus of death threats against him. In an era when even members of the Tea Party claim Martin Luther King as one of their own, we forget that he was the subject of intense vilification by racists in the North and the South. Hundreds of people in this gun-crazy country of ours have vowed to kill him. Bounties have been put on his head by white citizens groups. White cops barely disguised their contempt for a man they considered a fraudulent rabble-rouser whenever he visited their cities to lead a protest march. He was Reverend Al Sharpton long before Reverend Al was even old enough to shave. Martin Luther King's guilt-racked final year was one of humiliation, broken dreams, squandered opportunities, depression, loneliness, marginalization, and recurring premonitions of death. Even so, he felt compelled to stick to preaching the liberating truth of the gospel as a direct challenge to the principalities and powers of American empire. Anyone who wants to risk it and can watch actual video of Martin Luther King's April 3rd, 1968 sermon in Memphis should do so. He had returned to that town to help the sanitation workers who had gone on strike to protest horrific working conditions. A previous trip to Memphis resulted in a march that went awry when looting and violence broke out among an isolated pocket of protesters who were believed to have been planted by those interested in discrediting him. Whether they were or not, Dr. King was roundly castigated as a fading moral authority in a movement that was becoming more militant every day. The violence rattled him and forced him to do much prayer and soul searching before embarking on a return trip to Memphis. His final sermon never fails to stir us. There is tremendous prophetic power and dignity in his words. And this is what he said. "Well, I don't know what will happen now," he said, scanning the church filled with ordinary people who never lost confidence in him, even as he fell off the list of the most admired men in America for the first time in a decade. "We got some difficult days ahead," he said, "but it really doesn't matter to me now because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live. Long life, longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know that we as a people will get to the promised land." And Dr. King delivered that sermon one day before he was assassinated on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. It has been 47 years since his prophetic voice was silenced. Though there have been tremendous strides in many areas, especially in the area of racial equality in America, the promised land remains more rumor than reality. And since Dr. King's assassination, his reputation has undergone the kind of massive public relations rehab that does no profit any good after he or she is dead. In fact, it would be a source of embarrassment if he were standing here today. even before Dr. King was in the ground, those in the movement who at once dismissed him as irrelevant embraced him as a martyr for the cause. It didn't mean that they were any more committed to nonviolence than when he was alive, but they saw the value of being aligned with whatever symbolic power emerged from the tragedy of his death. From President Johnson on down, most responsible American politicians who weren't unreconstructed racists praised Martin Luther King as a great American who strove for colorblindness, whatever that is, throughout society. And those who once considered Dr. King a reprobate commie saw nothing wrong with dusting off the parts of his sermons and speeches that fit their agenda. They felt no qualms about claiming his moral authority as their own because he was in no position to contradict their shameful revisionism. Dr. King was dead, which is always the preferable posture of a meddlesome prophet. Over the years, the deification of Martin Luther King continued as more consideration was given to his "I Have a Dream" speech at the expense of his prophetic critique of American capitalism, militarism, and structural racism and inequality. Martin Luther King's final years, with its width of spiritual struggle and disgust with the American enterprise, gave way to the racial Pollyanna that continues to surround the civil rights leader to this day. In order to defang King and his prophetic witness, it was necessary for him to become the least offensive American who ever lived. In death, Martin Luther King was transformed from unpopular truth teller into a kindly, polite Negro who once made a great speech about judging people by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. He was no longer the Uncle Tom vilified by Black Power advocates, but he had become the kindly Black uncle that whites across the political spectrum felt comfortable bringing into their homes. Dr. King's prophetic radicalism gave way to bland accommodation with the powers and principalities he fought against with every ounce of his being. Instead of liberating the civil rights movement by forcing it to abandon the top-down model of leadership and embrace the collective wisdom of the grassroots, King's death became an opportunity to engage in the most profoundly misplaced cult of personality in American history. The prophet was becoming the star of the story instead of the prophet's message. In 1983, after much campaigning by civil rights groups, celebrities and sympathetic politicians and other folks, a federal Martin Luther King Jr. holiday was signed into law by none other than President Ronald Reagan. It became a companion piece for all of the Martin Luther King boulevards that crisscrossed huge lattices of urban America. A few years ago, an enormous monument that vaguely resembles Martin Luther King Jr. was unveiled near Washington's National Mall with great fanfare. It had cost $120 million and looked more like a tribute to China's Ming Dynasty than an acknowledgement of an American prophet who would have been appalled by the amount of money spent honoring his memory. By now, Martin Luther King has become so ensnared and our culture's sentimental veneer of nonsensical fable and symbol that very few were struck by the contradiction between the civil rights leader's life and the ostentatious tribute to his memory. There is either very little respect for or knowledge of the depths of his prophetic critique on the part of his deep-pocketed supporters. Oh, I left off the second clause. I don't want to sound like Judas complaining about how much perfume was poured on Jesus' head and feet by one of his grateful followers. But 120 million is a lot to spend on a monument for a man who would have been the first to oppose it. But this is the fate of modern prophets. They must be co-opted and their message denuded by supporters inclined to suffer from amnesia as they go about arranging honors for their fallen hero. When Jesus said that a prophet is never honored in his hometown by his own people, he was really talking about the prophet's message. Sometimes the best way to marginalize a prophet is to honor him excessively in ways that betray or undermine the message he or she died representing. That's certainly what happened to Jesus. He's honored everywhere, but his message is completely ignored and dishonored by the very people who claim to honor him most. In the case of Martin Luther King, his whole message of social and economic justice has been reduced over the years to a plea for racial reconciliation. That's it. To the extent that all we choose to know about his message is that he had some kind of dream, he can finally be absorbed into the indifferent mass mind of the American public without threatening anything of value, like our way of life. There's nothing dangerous about a prophet who has a day set aside for him by the federal government. Still, there's hope for the person who thirsts for righteousness and is willing to undergo a little inconvenience by actually reading what Martin Luther King had to say, or listening to recordings or watching videos uploaded to YouTube. Like Jesus, a little unfiltered Martin Luther King is shocking and upsetting to the system, which is why it isn't recommended. Better to gaze upon the marble bust of MLK than listen to his sermons, especially those dispatches from the year that preceded his death. And by all rights, MLK should be second to Jesus in unpopularity in America. Both represent radical critiques of the way we go about doing things in this country. They should be unpopular around the world for the same reason. They're not unpopular because what they truly are has been transformed into the Wonder Bread and grape juice of irrelevance. And there's a reason that prophets eventually end up on the chopping block. They aren't nice people by the prevailing standards of the world. They're strange, driven people who hear God's voice telling them to do suicidal things like speak truthfully. They aren't appropriate role models for anyone who wants to fit in. To mimic them is to sign one's own death warrant. This is why, despite the existence of an estimated 250,000 Protestant churches in this country, 17,000 Catholic parishes, and 41,000 denominations, it may be possible to count the number of truly prophetic Christians on one hand, perhaps even one finger. Imagine a country of 233,324,978 professing Christians, according to one evangelical polling website. And maybe we can think of one or two people that might qualify for prophet with a big P status. But are they in our immediate circle or community? Who fits that bill? Fortunately, there are plenty of people doing what we and they believe to be God's will, but they're no real threat to the status quo. The way prophets, as we historically think of them, always are. They aren't nuisances worth killing, and they would like to keep it that way, thank you very much. So the prophetic calling of the type we see in the Bible and in the example of the life of Martin Luther King comes with an expiration date stamped in blood. The genuine prophet, should he or she accept that call, is guaranteed to have a miserable time in the trenches, because challenging the status quo at the root level is always a suicidal act. The system does not take kindly to those who refuse to shut up, fall down, and worship the God of this world. That's not to say there aren't plenty of Christians and non-Christians willing to put themselves on the line for the sake of social justice. They do what we're all called to do: feed the poor, minister to the sick, comfort the widows and orphans in their distress, show hospitality to strangers, visit those in prison, defend those who can't defend themselves. They're simply nowhere near the majority of those inside and outside the church that have made their peace with institutional injustice. Churches are in the business of sticking around as long as they can. That's why congregations are encouraged to be pragmatic and reasonable, not fiery prophets in training. Members are expected to die from old age, not from crucifixion. Getting crucified over anything is some old school Jesus stuff. In the coming weeks, we're going to talk about some of this old school, old time Jesus stuff, and why it is imperative that we recover something of the spirit of prophetic witness when it comes to social justice. Thank you. Sorry I was late, folks. And I had to skip some stuff because some of the pages were kind of blurry. But my main point is that the prophetic Christian tradition is one that we all hunger to see return. There's not a church worth its salt that is not interested in recovering something of that spirit. And in fact, I know I'm talking to the converted. I'm talking to people who want to have a little bit of that return. But what does it mean? And it makes us all a little nervous to know that in order to be faithful, it will require stepping out of our comfort zone. It isn't something that we do easily. It isn't something that I do easily. I think of anyone in this room right now, I'm probably the least interested in doing anything remotely prophetic. But I am interested in having a discussion with people and exchanging ideas and maybe getting a sense of how I, as a Christian, can proceed in my life and being just a little bit more faithful by learning from the example of other people and exchanging ideas with them about how to do it. As a newspaper columnist, I'm sort of used to the slings and arrows every week that come my way. I can write about innocuous stuff and be denounced. So I've developed something of a thick skin. So in many ways, it's easy for me to say, hey, everyone should be prophetic, everyone should be prophetic, because, you know, even though I'm not necessarily prophetic as a newspaper columnist, I suffer slings and arrows, and, you know, you get used to it, you get over it. But I think there's something else here, and I think that the civil rights movement transformed American society because it was at its root a prophetic Christian movement. And to the extent that it stepped out of that witness and out of that energy, it sort of lost its relevance for the larger society. And it's no coincidence that, you know, after Dr. King crumpled onto the balcony of the Lorraine Motel after being shot, a lot of the energy sort of deflated from the movement, because he had become the most articulate and the most important spokesman for a movement that should have been more diversified and less hierarchical. The movement had begun to suffer from many of the things that Dr. King was criticizing. It was top down, it was massive, and it was bureaucratic. It could not survive the death of its charismatic leader in quite the same way. Fortunately, legislation was able to address a lot of the major sins of American society, but not all of them. And so the movement in many ways just kind of staggered on under a series of mediocre leaders. And once you had mediocre leaders, you had a society that was very, very comfortable with the way things were going. So instead of me going on and on, are there things that you guys want to say or reactions to the speech? And I'll be glad to take some reaction.
Tony, how do you account for the movement becoming hierarchical and talk? I mean, in terms of leadership terms, how do you explain that evolution?
I think in the 1950s, when the civil rights movement really got its start, it was reacting to high-profile arrests. I think you needed to have folks who were good at organizing and strategizing. You needed a series of lawyers who would take, who would represent those who were arrested unjustly. And you had to have folks who knew what they were doing, knew their way around a courtroom and so forth, because a lot of the advances came via brilliant lawyers who just knew that this was a way, because you couldn't appeal to the consciences of people. You had to use law to get at them. And so that was that initial phase. Let's use the law. I mean, in the 1950s, I mean, we were already, you know, close to a century removed from the Civil War. And yet we were dealing with what was slavery by another name. And so, you know, I was born in 1960. I mean, I, you know, in 1965 and 64 and 65, in a sense, that's when I got my full rights with the signing of that landmark legislation. And so, in fact, when I visited the LBJ Museum, maybe it was like 10 years ago in Austin, Texas. Behind glass, there is the desk that President Johnson had used to sign the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. And it was one of the most profoundly moving experiences of my life. I see lots of things and, you know, around the world and paintings that are deeply moving and so forth, but nothing ever moved me as much as seeing the desk that, you know, 5 years into my life gave me rights that should have been given 100 years earlier in 1865, but it was 1965 that any of this stuff started to happen. And that was the prophetic witness of the church, the black church, the white church. If you look at the footage of the people, you go see the movie Selma, or you go look at the actual footage online, which is far scarier, and you see all of the folks that came from the North to come down to the South to be brutalized. Those were prophets. Those were people who were willing to put their lives on the line. And they were willing to follow a prophet. And this prophet had feet of clay, and he was not perfect, just like all of us. But he still listened to the voice of his God and marched where he was told to march and to go where he was told to go and to go to that. And he knew that he was not going to make it. You know you're not going to make it at a certain point. And he just said, that does not matter. You know, I've seen the mountaintop. I may not get there with you, but one day we will get to the promised land. That is just biblical language, pure and simple. That is the Bible, and that is annoying to our culture. Pure and simple.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Speaking of getting to the promised land, well, I remember we saw the movie Selma, and then at one point the question was raised, well, what else do these people want?
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about the situation now, and if you look at the tremendous disparity in income, in education, look at the quality of the teachers and the schools between black and white. Are we going to get there?
It's interesting. I mean, we can look back on what King did, and we know just sort of historically what came next. We knew where he was and what happened next and what the result of this action was and that action was. But here we are in 2015 on February 1st, and we don't even know what the next minute is going to be. And we don't know who's going to win the Super Bowl. We don't know anything. We are just sort of like in this moment in time, and the future has not happened, and all we have is now, and all we can do is try to be faithful to what we know we have to do, and almost in a sense trust that we will get there. I think the thing about the promised land is it is always elusive. Whether you're Moses in the desert with the people wandering for 40 years, and you call Joshua over one day and you say, look, man, I am not going to cross over with you. You know, God has let me look over into, you know, the promised land, but he's told me that I'm not going to make it. You know, it's you just have to trust that if we don't make it, our children will make it.
I have a response to that. Then what is the church's part? What are we to be doing?
Well, ideally, we are supposed to have been the promised land. We are supposed to be that place where all of these inequities and all of these things do not hold any water and do not hold any place and are not a part of that we are a counterculture to that. The church has to undergo a revolution. And for each congregation, it's going to be different. But I can tell you that when I go to black churches in the inner city of Pittsburgh, I just see unabashed worship of mammon, of money, of flashiness, of sort of like despicable materialism, and it makes me sick. There's less prophetic spirit in black churches than there are in suburban white churches. They're equally ridiculous, but it is especially disappointing for me to go into a black church and to see a preacher in an expensive suit and watches and rings and all this gaudiness. And I don't generally last in those places when I go to worship, because I'm always dissatisfied with it, and I usually say something to the wrong person who then makes it clear that, you know, there's plenty of other places I can go. There has to be a revolution of the heart at all of these places, all of these churches. It's probably, maybe it's the nature of being American. Maybe we're just so oriented towards having, like, you know, an example. You know, we need an Uberman to show us the way. I don't think that that's going to work anymore. I think it has to be decentralized. I think that people just have to take the gospel seriously enough to take it upon themselves to be minor prophets. I mean, you don't have to walk around for 3.5 years naked like the prophets in the Old Testament. You know, you don't have to do the crazy stuff that the desert fathers did, you know, stand on top of a pole for 7 years, you know, naked, and you know, but you got to do something. Yes, sir?
What do you feel called to do as a writer?
As a writer? Well, I feel that as a writer, to the extent that I can, in, 20 inches on Tuesday and 20 inches on Friday, you know, to sort of like point out the obvious absurdities, you know, of our, you know, national hypocrisies, our spiritual hypocrisies. Because as a columnist, I have the, you know, the room to do that. I can write about literally anything that I want. I've over X amount of years, I sort of like earned the right to do that. I have a following, you know, and people write to me and so forth. I mean, I'm well read, you know, locally and throughout the country. The column gets reproduced lots of places and so forth. But, you know, I'm just sort of struggling. I'm just sort of struggling with what it means, you know. You know, I mean, since 1979, I've sort of had this monkey on my back, as it were. You know, this faith that has exacted a toll on me in many ways. I mean, I have to be a Christian. I'm not perfect, but I just don't have any other way out of this pact, as it were. So I got to be obnoxious. Yes. I'm sorry.
Do
I pay a price? Well, it's kind of uncomfortable at home. My wife is not a Christian. In fact, she's one of the city's leading atheists. So yeah, there's a personal price. There's, you know, I think my I'm perceived as sort of self-righteous, and so, you know, I make a lot of people uncomfortable. I think yeah, but nothing. No, do I have to worry about, you know, an income? No, I you know, I do well. I don't have to worry about being thrown in jail, except for when I, you know, spar with the police in Swissvale or whatever. But, you know, I'm all right. Ma'am.
You need to know that
Big P, big P. I will next week. I will next week. Yes, ma'am.
I've read, I think, three of Ben Carson's books.
Uh-huh. By who?
Westmore.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, the thing that was interesting is it was their mothers that made a difference in their life. And Dr. Ben Carson, who ended up being the head of neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins, he was raised by a mother who had a third-grade education. And both of her boys are, one is a doctor and one is a, I forget what type of engineer. But anyway, I guess I'm saying as women or as fathers, we are so important in teaching our children not to be prejudiced and to educate them. And education is so important.
Absolutely. I think that education is one of the keys to the elimination of poverty, which is why the disparity in funding for public schools is so outrageous. Because, you know, my wife graduated from public schools, and she graduated from North Allegheny High School, which is one of the best public schools in the region. You know, obviously the folks in the North Hills are willing to pay dearly for fine education. Here, I mean, you guys have absolutely fine schools in the South Hills. The fights over tax rates are legendary because all of you folks are deeply involved in the education of your kids. You have a stake in it. Unfortunately, in the city, you know, you don't have that level of involvement because you have people basically trying to scratch out an existence, you know, just trying to make it. And tax rates are just not going to go up to improve the schools. If there were another way to fund schools, I think it would go a long way towards making things a little more equitable. I mean, that's certainly what you see in other countries. But it's a discussion that's that we need to have here that we're not having. So, yes, ma'am.
I have a comment about Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But I've read a lot, but when I saw it, it is such a, to me, it's a call to do more. And there were so many black families there with their children, mm-hmm. trying to teach them, because obviously they don't know what it's like before. And to me, it's a call to do more. And I wonder how many people visit the memorial.
I think if if the Martin Luther King Memorial becomes a catalyst for revolutionary change and thinking and so forth, you know, I will be proven wrong, and I will be the first to say, thank goodness for this thing. But for me, and maybe this, a lot of this probably has to do with my, maybe even a certain prejudice I have just as someone who is interested in aesthetics. I just think it's tacky. You know, I'm not moved by it. I look at it and I just see, exactly. People, sure. So, but the question becomes, you have to ask, what would King have said? He said, "Ma'am, just put me in a plain box and just say I was a drum major for justice. And that's all. You don't really need to have like a big thing." The thing is that when you spend that kind of money, what do you do for an encore? Like, what next? You have $120 million sung to a memorial, and people are now saying, what do you want from us now? You got your memorial. What else do you want now? And there is no next. There is no organized. I can't think of anything other than these protests against police brutality that involve a systematic attack on racism in America. That's just it. There's no program. It's just, let's just spend money to honor someone. So, I'm sorry, folks. It is almost time to go, but come next week and I will have a much cheerier presentation about being prophetic. So thank you.